Johnny Mosley's Olympic gold medal at the Nagano Games in 1998 set the stage for a post-competition career that would be the envy of any athlete. Of course, a lot of athletes have followed a victory with a spot on late-night TV, as Mosley did on the David Letterman show. But not many are invited back, and even fewer go on to host their own show, as Mosley did for 3 years on MTV, which was a much more important entity then than now, or make the cover of Rolling Stone, or host Saturday Night Live, or segue into the announcing booth, as Mosley did for NBC at the Vancouver Olympics. We'll talk to Mosley about these career highlights, but I want to share a little of the backstory about our relationship, which I very much doubt is common knowledge. You see, I was marketing director at Head Winter Sports when Mosley was looking for a new equipment sponsor going into the Salt Lake City Olympics, where he would be the defending gold medalist in the freestyle mogul competition. While I was trying to woo him into our fold, we went out to dinner together in Marin County, where we bonded while tootling around on electric scooters while wearing Halloween masks. Mine was a big blue rabbit. I don't recall what Mosley wore. Not long after, he signed a handsome six-figure deal to ski for Head, leaving me with the task of equipping him with skis that, at the time, we didn't make. This would lead to the Mad Tricks, which would later become the name of his signature video game. Joe Kutz, then director of the ski magazine Gear Tests, called the Mad Tricks the worst ski he'd ever tested. Trollia came up with a ludicrous contraption that would allow the binding to be unlocked and turned around, so it was center-mounted in one position and conventionally positioned in the other. That might have been a decent idea if the ski had been any good, but it was rubbish. That Mosley was able to come within a whisker of winning another Olympic medal on it, a result we'll explore as it was one of the greatest injustices in freestyle history, if not in fact the most egregious example, of an athletic organization taking revenge on an athlete it regarded as dangerously disrespectful. We'll talk about this historic example of organizational overreach, along with many other career highlights in this week's edition of Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Johnny Mosley, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jackson. That was an amazing intro. It really brought me back to so many interesting times in my life and made me grateful for our relationship. Very nuanced view that only you could have.
I appreciate that, Johnny. I'd like to open our chat, as I often do, with a brief overview of your origins as a skier. Your Wikipedia entry notes that you're the only person born in Puerto Rico to become a member of the U.S. ski team, a weird distinction that your career quickly reduced to a footnote. Surely you didn't ski in Puerto Rico as you left the island when you were only five. So where did you step into a pair of skis, and what was the arc of your early development?
It's the opening line on my Wikipedia page that I'm like the first Puerto Rican to make it to the Olympics from skiing, which is true, I guess. And I've also read that I didn't come here and start skiing until I was nine or something like that. So they're all close enough. But what happened was my dad is originally from the Bay Area out here, Northern California. And he grew up skiing a little bit, but not a ton. As soon as he was able to do it on his own, he loved to go up to Sugar Bowl. And then when he had an opportunity to go to Squaw, he loved it. And so he was like kind of a skiing fan, but just a casual skier. But then in sort of like mid-60s, he moved to San Juan, Puerto Rico to run this like manufacturing business that he had making storm windows. So he was living down there in San Juan. And he met my mom, who was a buddy's, who was on vacation with her sister, who was a buddy's wife, you know, that type of story. So anyway, they, long story short, they ended up getting married and having three kids down there. I was the youngest of three. I was born in 75. About 2 years later, 77, the business went south and they moved back here to the Bay Area and moved this time up into Marin. And he was building houses and doing construction and all that type of stuff. So I was two at the time. My brothers were like five and no more than that, seven and eight. So he immediately packed us up every weekend to go to Tahoe and ski, to go to Squaw, and would get ski leases, you know, partner up with other families. And he gave us a couple lessons. And the teachers there were like, hey, these guys are ready for Mighty Mites and race team. So just, and he was like, okay, let's do it. So my mom and him signed us up for the programs there. Me and Mighty Mites, and which is kind of the juniorest of the junior program there, starts when you're around three and a half, I think I was. And then my brothers went into the race team. And, you know, it kind of evolved from there.
And they say also in this maybe somewhat garbled Wikipedia that you were on the freestyle ski team by 1992 and regarded as something of a prodigy. They mentioned that, in fact, you showed more promise than your elder siblings. And sure enough, you won your first junior national title in freestyle skiing while still on the what's called Palisades. We're all trying to train ourselves to not call it squaw anymore. Does that jibe somewhat with your recollection?
Yeah, the date 1992 and making the ski team, I guess, is kind of a loosely accurate just to go with the quick sort of version of all this. Essentially, freestyle skiing, being it the original form of freestyle skiing, moguls, aerials, and ballet, was starting to absolutely take off in 85 around Tahoe and kind of worldwide. It was on the World Cup. It was being considered for the Olympics, but it wasn't in. And that's when my oldest brother, who was a kind of a skateboarder, surfer, punk music enthusiast, he and his buddies saw freestyle, and Hot Dog the Movie had just been filmed there. And so there was all these like pro freestylers around, and he saw that and was like, we're doing that. And he entered us in this contest right under KT to the left of the fingers there, a dual mogul contest. My other brother, who's the middle brother, I'm the youngest in the middle, and we all entered it. And we got to the bottom. We had a great time. And the newly formed freestyle team coach, who had just started the first, I could call it the Palisades Tahoe freestyle team, but it was the Squaw Valley freestyle team at the time, said, hey, you guys should join the freestyle team. A guy named Kevin Whiteman, who was a World Cup combined skier, ballet specialist. And he had just formed the team. And my oldest brothers were like, Dad, we want to do freestyle, not racing. And so my dad was a little bit agnostic. It was kind of the end of the season. He liked racing, but he wasn't like one of these guys who's like, you have to race or there's no other thing. He was just kind of like, hey, these guys are having fun. They're busy on the weekends, and that's good. And so they convinced my parents to sign us up for the freestyle team. And so my parents went to the freestyle team guy, Kevin Whiteman, and said, hey, we have three kids who want to do it. And he looked at the ages. He's like, I could take these older kids, but this guy's too young. He's like, I don't know, 7, 8 years old. He's like 8 years old. And my parents are like, well, we're not doing two programs. We're not going here and there. If you want these two, you're taking this guy too. So I became like the youngest guy on the team. And at that time, you're really talking about only like probably in my age category, there's probably only like 10 kids in all of the Tahoe Far West region that are doing freestyle at the time. So I got a lot of positive feedback. You know, you're doing great, kid. You're doing great. And so I had a great time, had some great coaches. We learned a lot of ballet because Kevin, that was his thing. So our first day on the freestyle team was ballet, learning tricks and spins. And then we had a great upright aerial kicker site there that we would then go jump. And then we'd go ski moguls the rest of the time. And one thing led to another. And yes, my oldest brother got us into it. He kind of kicked out around high school. He and my older brother, other brother, actually went to high school in Squaw for a little bit, to the academy there. Then my next brother down, Rick, who was 5 years older than me, he was sick. He was an incredible skier. And so he was top in his age category in the region. So he became like my mentor, coach, chaperone. And so he got really motivated and, you know, wanted to go for it. And that's how I ended up really digging in, because he was 16, able to drive. So he had made contacts, and we would go to the summer camp. We would drive to Hood and camp out on the way. And then we'd go to these ski camps, and we'd spend days up there training and getting in the mix. So that's where I first started to do my first flips. So anyway, it just became really ingrained. And then Rick and I went back, and, you know, on the tour that year, and he was out of junior nationals by that point. But anyway, long story short, we both ended up being like first and second on NORAMs together. So he was really good skier. And we both ended up on World Cup together. The thing that sent me into overdrive, and where you hear that 92 number, is I won junior nationals, which is everyone under 19, when I was 15. And I think that is 19, right around 1992. I think that's that year. And that was the year they put me at, that kind of sent me into another realm, that put me on the NORAM tour, which I then won. And then that put me on the World Cup tour, on the US ski team, in time to try for the 1994 Olympics.
And that turned out to be a bummer, because you had been sort of set up to maybe perhaps feel, after all this initial success, that you were probably going to make the games, and you did. How did that affect you?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I had been on sort of a tear from the time I was, what, nine, I guess, all the way. I mean, it was just like everything I was getting into. I mean, I had crashed at plenty of contests and you know, had plenty of sort of disappointments. But in general, I was winning everything. It was like, you know, I was kind of everything I got into, I'd won. And so the World Cup was a very humbling experience. I got smoked immediately. I could not bust into the, you know, top 10 even. And so it was like, Jesus, maybe that's it. Am I ever going to win again? And in my mind, I definitely was like, oh man, I should be able to make this 94 Olympics. And I wasn't like super far off, but there was definitely, I was probably the, you know, six on a team of four. So that was not going to work. But it was probably the best thing that ever happened. You know, I mean, for a lot of obvious cliche reasons, it humbled me. It made me reevaluate the rest of my life and see what I really wanted to do and start to really hustle to get a lot of resources and write sponsors and try to like get my life organized in a way that I could make a run and do better.
Did you have your own coach?
No. I mean, at that point, for me, I was super fortunate in that my brother Rick was like my personal coach and had been since I was a kid. And he's a very technical guy. He's a very analytical guy and kind of a hard, tough love guy. And so he was incredible for me. But at that point, no, you're just kind of like moving around on NORAMs. You move from your local coach to the sort of junior development team coach, a guy named Donnie St. Pierre, who was great. And then when you get a World Cup, you move into, you know, the World Cup coaches. And they were great. This guy named Jeff Good, but you're definitely like the low man on the totem pole. And the way freestyle works is you've got one or two coaches for 10 dudes and 10 girls. So there's a lot of jockeying for position that goes on, let's just say. And sort of like, there's only so much a coach can focus on. And especially if you're trying to get an Olympic team ready.
But so, you catch fire in the year preceding Nagano.
Yeah. So then if you fast forward a little bit from 94, you know, back on the World Cup tour, and I started to have some success kind of, I guess, end of 94, maybe, you know, into 95, I started to like break into the top 10. I got a couple fourths, and this was under Jeff Good, the head coach. So I was figuring it out roughly. I was still skiing combined at the time. So I was doing ballet, aerials, and moguls. And I think in 96, I believe I ended up winning. That's when I had a couple big things happen. I ended up like winning my first World Cup in moguls, and I also won the World Cup combined title. So I was getting, you know, at that time I was doing triple twisting, triple backflips. I was starting to get, you know, top fives in aerials and top six in ballet. And so I was able to take the combined skiing crown, which had always been a goal of mine. And I also took the overall World Cup title. So I had some success, but I definitely wasn't the premier mogul guy, right? I touched the podium a couple times, but I actually ended up in the lead for the overall title in 96 in moguls as well, but lost it right at the last competition to Jean-Luc Brossard, the reigning Olympic champion from 94. And it was frustrating because I didn't even need to really win that event. I just needed to place well in the final, you know, like, I don't know, top six, top seven, and I couldn't get it done. And that was an important moment as well, because similar to the 94 moment, it was sort of humbling. And it was like, okay, how do I become that guy? How do I become like the Jean-Luc Brossard of the world, the Sergei Shuputsov of the world, the Edgar Groperons, all these Olympic champions that just, and World Cup champions that seem to like, every time they stepped in the gate, everyone sat there and was like, it's theirs to lose. Like, how do you get to that point, right? And that's when I came across, not necessarily somewhat by my own doing, but really Jeff Good, the head coach of the U.S. team at that time. He was a great coach. And he also basically said, hey, I need some help with this crew, to a guy named Cooper Schell. He was like, I've got a lot to do just running this team. I need someone to help me on the hill and help with all the technical analysis and sort of video and all that stuff. And he brought in this guy that was revered by all of the sort of mogul skiing world named Cooper Schell, very technical, a guy known as like, you know, this beautiful technical skier that did have success. He won World Cups, but was short of the Olympics, mainly because of his age, right? Like those guys that competed before, you know, in that era didn't even have the opportunity to go to the Olympics. And so Good convinced Cooper to come on board. And Cooper came on and sort of analyzed all of us. And, you know, he just sort of, I don't think he was really impressed with any of us. He was sort of like, you guys, not only do you all kind of suck at moguls, but you're all sort of soft. Our era was, you know, these like rip roaring guys who had found the sport on their own with barely any incentive to, you know, with no Olympic incentive. Like they just had come to it naturally. Maybe they had more fundamentals from slalom skiing days. And so we are all kind of jockeying for his attention, really, I think is a good way to put it. There was a moment we were up in Mount Hood, and it was the summer before we really got into it for the Olympics. And he basically sat us down after this camp and was like, hey, you guys, the Olympics is coming up. It's not really a good time for you guys to go home and take a break and come back, because I think we had a couple of weeks off. And he's like, if anyone wants to stay and work with me, you guys suck. You need a lot of work. And I'll be here. And so I was like, had this moment there where I was like, shit, this is it. Like this, my whole life's come down to this, like this stretch. Like I'm trying to get to the Olympics. I'm not trying to just get there. I want to win. What else am I doing? What am I going to do there? So I basically was like, I'm in. And I just, you know, ditched all my plans. And I ended up telling him I was in. And to my surprise, I was the only one that stayed. So it was just Cooper and I. And I crashed on his couch, and we kind of started like woke up the next morning like a few people who had like, you know, just had been on a date. And it was like, okay, now what? And so we got to know each other real quick, and he started kind of digging into his philosophy, and we started watching a lot of video and obviously going up to the hill to Hood every day and skiing. And we just kind of dug in, and things went from there.
Where did you develop the mute grab, which became, in fact, your logo and captured the imagination of everyone? It seemed to be something that, from the viewer who is outside the world of skiing, it looked something like exceptional. And the term mute grab, I think it initially intrigued people because what the hell is that? Is there a talking grab somewhere? what does it mean? And where? How did that evolve to become, I think, so it sort of blew away the world when you pulled it off in the Olympics?
No, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I can touch on both of those. My knowledge of why it's called a mute grab, I've done my fair share of homework on it, but probably, you know, it's, I'm not sure there's a lot of literature on it, so I kind of have to piece it together. But my understanding is that, and then we'll get into how I arrived on it and all that right. stuff. But it was a skateboarding trick. And the story is that Tony Hawk was in his, you know, young pro days, was over in Japan or something doing a demo. And, you know, if you were a pro skateboarder, then you did a lot of demos, basically. You went from town to town and grabbed some local skaters there, and they'd put on a show in a parking lot, be a half pipe or a street skating thing or something like that. But he said they showed up and there was this kid there. He was a deaf mute, I guess, or he was a mute. And yeah, and he was a ripping skater, and he would do this trick where if in skateboarding, imagine that you're regular footed, and so you have your left foot forward, and when you come up the ramp and you air, you reach down with your left hand and grab right around where your toe is on the board and then tweak it back. And that would be different. That would be what they call them. So all the guys, that was unique. They hadn't done that. They usually grab behind the left heel or on the nose, or I think back way behind on the behind the right heel, or with their right hand down. You know, a very standard grab would be their right hand in between their two feet or on the tail. So this unique position of reaching across the board earned this kid, you know, the right to, you know, have a unique trick. And they, because the kid was deaf mute, they called it a mute grab. And
did not, you know that, like, that backstory. That's fabulous.
Exactly. So then that transferred from skateboarding, like all these tricks did, to snowboarding. And so, and then eventually to skiing. And so in snowboarding, it'd be the same idea. Depending on left foot forward, right foot forward, you would reach across the board and tweak it back. And then, you know, not to go deep into the whole thing, but obviously snowboarding is what inspired the whole new school of skiing movement, which I was sort of immersed in, right, in the, call it 96, 90, was about, I would say, sort of pinned as kind of the beginning of it. And we were these, you know, there were these three mogul skiers based out of Quebec, J.F. Cousin, J.P. Auclair, and Vincent Dorion, who basically had started hanging out in the terrain parks, even though they were technically like not allowed. And they started watching the snowboarders and they started admiring the snowboarders and they started, you know, ripping off the tricks of the snowboarders. And one kid in particular, a kid named J.P. Auclair, was particularly adept at it. And he was the one who started doing this mute grab where he would reach down with his right hand this time, reach across and grab his left ski right in front of the binding and tweak it back. And that was a mute grab. And so he started doing it to 360 and all that stuff. And while he was into 360 and all that stuff, I had hung out with these guys a bit, immersed with them in the summer. And so I had seen them. I wanted to get in on it because I was a former aerialist. I had a lot of air sense and I just loved snowboarding. Basically started hanging out with these guys. And I ripped off that trick from them. I just got lucky because the three of them were not quite there with regards to their level of mogul skiing. So what they were actually, a couple of them were on the World Cup tour that year, not JP, but JF. And through a combination of the Canadian system and just their youth, they didn't make the Olympics in 98. So I was like, thank you very much. I'll take that and put it in my run. And so I started doing it in the moguls, probably about, call it December of, I mean, we had been doing it in the park and all that stuff, right? Like, I think I did my first 1080 mute grab in the park for the Scott Gaffney video called Breathe, but we really hadn't taken it in the moguls yet. And so I started doing that along with a kid named Julien Regnier the Forg, a French kid, and who actually did make the Olympics for France. And he did that trick, but he didn't qualify for the finals. And then that was it. So anyway, as far as for all intents and purposes, I started doing it actually the first time. It's funny. That's kind of interesting. Is in order to make the Olympics on the US team, you've got to win a World Cup pretty much. So like my first two contests were spent trying to secure my spot. And I did that. I came because of my summer training with Cooper. I had sort of redeveloped my whole style of skiing and my comfort level, and it worked. Like I came out on the hill and I was killing it. I basically got second in the first contest, won the next two. So my spot was secured and I was just doing Iron Cross 360s at the time. So I was like, okay, I got my spot. Now I got one to burn. And there was a World Cup right before the Olympics in Breckenridge. And I'm like, I'm going to throw it. Let's see what happens here. Because at that point, I'm not sure anyone had even thrown it too much in a World Cup. I mean, I don't want to get in trouble with the hardcores, but maybe Julien had done one. Maybe JF had done one. I don't know. Maybe JF. They must have. So I threw it for my first time in a contest and I did it nicely, did it big, and the judges freaking loved it and I won. And it was like, and 2 weeks later I went to the Olympics, and at that point no one was really gonna catch it, right? You know, three quarters of the crew were doubters, and then say, you know, the rest of the crew maybe couldn't do it, and then the rest of the crew didn't have time to learn it. So I all of a sudden had this very asymmetric advantage going into the Olympics in 98. And that's it.
Wow. That is great. Thanks for sharing all of that. I want to share with my dear listeners something else. It's a vignette drawn from the same pre-Olympic period. You appeared in Greg Stump's Fistful of Moguls that came out in 98, but was filmed in partly in 96. And none other than Glenn Plake, who is himself a seriously good mogul skier. He may not have competed at the level that you did, but a man knew how to get down a mogul field, usually on downhill skis, which is ludicrous, but never mind that. And he predicted in that movie, well, maybe it was during the shooting, I don't know if it ever made it actually into the final cut of the movie itself, but he predicted that you, then a teenager, would win gold at the next Olympics. So we can add to Plake's own Hall of Fame career a talent for prognostication. What do you remember? Festival of Moguls, was that your first appearance in a feature-length film?
Yeah, so that's the whole Plake. Man, I'm trying to be somewhat as brief as I can, Jackson, because these are like these. Okay, cool, cool. I mean, that's I've been enjoying actually. I haven't done much of it because obviously it takes kind of the right audience to really go deep into all this stuff. But I enjoy it because there's so many little layers that I sometimes even forget about. But yeah, so real quick with Plake, I loved Plake. I was just a fan of Plake. I mean, we go way back, right? He competed in moguls in the Far West region back in like the early days when I was just getting started. And I actually didn't know him at the time. He was from South Lake and he would come up and compete here and there. And then, you know, you just kind of know him because he was a big character even then, right? So, you know, then he disappeared, right? And that was the time when that's a whole nother podcast, when he ended up in Europe and, you know, got in trouble with the law, but then he was skiing and then the whole stump era. And then obviously he showed back up for me in the Greg Stump movies. And I had a friend who I always would go see the Warren Miller films with, and ended up being a cinematographer guy. But back then you just had a camera and we'd go out and make movies. And he was like, "Hey, have you seen these Greg Stump films, man? We got to go to one of these." So he ended up taking me to like Groove Requiem in the Key of Ski. And then we went back and watched Blizzard and started like, you know, digging into the Stump anthologies. And we were like huge fans, you know, and at that time, then I'm starting to make my way out of the World Cup. And next thing you know, Plake decides to like that he's back into moguls. And like he comes back and he starts hanging out with us like at mogul camps and he brings Stump. And we're just like, holy crap, Greg Stump and Plake are like want to hang out with us. And ski moguls. And we're like, this is freaking amazing. So anyway, they started filming us and hanging out with us. And I hit it off right away with Plake. I just loved him. He was really into wrenching on cars. I was as well. So we started hanging out more and more off campus down in Tahoe. I would bring my car out to his shop in Fallon, Nevada and wrench on it. I had a really good buddy named Armin that I was living with that was really into wrenching on cars too. And so Plake and I became friends. Plake became a really good ally, great advice. He's the one who got me on K2. We just became close. And, you know, then they got deeper into making Fistful of Moguls. And of course we started, you know, doing whatever we could. And it was just an incredible experience. And, you know, I'll never forget Plake's like front row with the American flag waving it at world championships in Nagano the year before the Olympics. And so, and I didn't even know that he knew that I was that good. Until I saw that, I didn't know he thought that maybe I would win. So that was obviously just a huge support. And he was part of it. You know, I mean, he helped support me through that whole thing and gave me a lot of great advice. So love play.
Interesting that he was your liaison to getting on K2, a brand with whom you are still associated.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was obviously a huge deal. I mean, he and that brand were so tightly meshed.
Let's talk about the dinner roll that you created to push the boundaries of the FIS prohibition against inverted aerials in mogul competition. Dear listeners, just to briefly explain, the dinner roll is essentially a 720 with one rotation around the vertical axis, which is relatively normal, and a second rotation around the horizontal axis. So your body's now parallel with the planet, but your feet aren't below your head. aren't above your head, which would be the violation. And you had to petition the Olympic Skiing Federation to get the aerial maneuver approved. But there seems little question that your attempt to stretch the boundaries of what was allowed left a sour taste among the sport's powerful European contingent. First, before we get into their whole attitude, how long did it take you to perfect the dinner roll?
Parallel with the planet. I like that, Jackson. I mean, that's right up there with Spin Doctor, which this is a different story, but Jackson came up with this great poster when I went to head called Spin Doctor, and it was brilliant, but I don't even think I was smart enough to realize what a Spin Doctor was at that time. So anyway, that was brilliant.
How long did it take you to perfect the dinner roll?
Yeah, the dinner roll story. So the dinner roll, let's see. Okay, so after 98, I went on a whirlwind tour. The sport was changing. I knew I wanted to be where the free ride world was going. So like, you know, we were X Games, Big Air, Slopestyle. I knew that's where skiing was going. That's where my peers were going. That's where JFJP, all those guys were going. I could just feel like that's where freestyle is meant to evolve. And that's where it was evolving too. And it was so clear. So one of the first things I did was go compete in the 99 X Games in Crested Butte, Colorado. And before that, I had been up in Hood with that whole crew, the whole kind of new school of freestyle skiing, the French Canadian kids, JFJP, all those guys. And I had envisioned and we were doing all the 360s, mute grabs and landing backwards. And, you know, there was a whole, every day there was a new trick being created at some point. And I woke up one morning with a vision for this trick, and I'd seen it in my head, which I commonly visualize things. But this one, I was like, I saw it so clearly that I could do it. And it was based loosely on a trick I loved in snowboarding called a rodeo. And the cool thing about a rodeo flip and the cool thing about snowboarding in general is it totally, because they're standing sideways, they kind of reinvented all the physics of aerials, right? Like it's a totally different takeoff. They would carve off the jumps as they were taking off in a different direction. And that was what was signature about a rodeo, is you were basically carving one way while you hurled your meat in another way. So it created these like very interesting vectors and allowed you to get into these weird rotations that we never thought of in aerials, right? And that was something obviously the French Canadian kids picked up on and were already on the way. So I envisioned this trick where I would rotate flat like that with that similar kind of rodeo takeoff. And I would get, you know, all the way around to seven. Whereas like JF Cousin was doing kind of a, almost like a loop 540, what he called a loop 540 rodeo, landing backwards. So that had been there too. So I took one and flattened it out. And I thought I was so, it's back to your story, is how to perfect it. I thought I had it down so well that as soon as I got to Whistler in the summer, I went straight to the wind lip up there, back behind the glacier, which is this beautiful, like, you know, easy jump with a big long landing everyone hits. And I just went for it. And I was like, not even close. I freaking packed it in and dislocated my shoulder, which had been dislocated before. And basically I was out. So I went back down to the village. I couldn't really ski it. I was able to get it back together, you know, like it would be one of those things where once it went out, I needed a few days to recover and then I could get back after it. Then I'm like, okay, let's back up a step. Let's go to the water ramps. So they had built a water ramp in Whistler at that time and a trampoline. So I started kind of methodically approaching the trick. And lo and behold, I figured it out on the water ramps and went right up to the hill and started doing it. And it worked out. And that's actually in one of Johnny Cesare's movies, 13, I think. And the following winter, I went and did it at the X Games in 99 and got second.
Excuse me, did you do that in moguls or in aerials when you
were— Oh, no. So, yeah, at this point, I'm really only I'm doing this all not even aerials. This is now big air. So this is like terrain park type stuff. So this is the X Games 99 was the first ever big air. So it's just— it's just a big jump, like a snowboard style jump, not an inverted jump. And so we were all starting to compete in these different contests that were popping up. The X Games, the US Open of Slopestyle popped up in Vail, which was a series of jumps and rails. And so it was—
excuse me, Johnny, did you also have to petition to maintain your amateur status while you attended these other quasi-professional events?
Well, that's an interesting subject. Essentially, what I did was I just, after the Olympics in 98, well, people should understand that the pro amateur, you know, line had already been breached long before. We were all getting paid at least some amount of money. For me, it was starting in 93, right? So that line had been broached in skiing long before. Now, it was limited because the ski team would only allow you to approach pool sponsors. So you couldn't go out into the open market. You're only allowed to try to get money from people who also paid into the ski team pool. So you were limited, and then you were allowed like one outside corporate sponsor on your head. So it was limited, but at least it was open. Now, when what you're getting into is a different region. When I when I told the ski team I wanted to go do pro events, my whole goal after the 98 Olympics is I wanted to stay domestic. I wanted to do lots of events. I wanted to be on TV more, because when you go on the World Cup, you're freaking on TV twice a year. It's very hard to sell against that or get any notoriety. And I knew that this other movement was happening that I wanted to be a part of. So I just was like, see you later. I'll do you guys are gonna have two World Cups in America. I'll do those two Mogul World Cups. I'm going to go do these three pro events that GGP or IMG is putting on. I'm also going to do the X Games. I'm going to do the US Open of Slopestyle. That's going to be like seven events on TV throughout the year. And I'm going to create my own event called the Johnny Mosley Invitational, which was a combo of skier cross and slopestyle. Overall champion wins. So you have to do both. So I created basically my own league for myself. And the ski team really, at that point, they put up a little fight, but they knew I wasn't going back and there was nothing they could really do about it. So they took their cord of blood when I tried to come back for the Olympics, and we can get into that. But so at that point, though, they were just happy. You know, I had some leverage, right? I knew they wanted me in the domestic World Cups and all that stuff. And in my mind, I knew that they were doing the wrong thing, that they needed to come this way. But at the time, they saw the X Games as competition. They were like, it's not sanctioned and, you know, fist, blah, 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 blah. But I was like, you guys are missing it, man. This is you guys should be doing this with all your competitors, not just me. So anyway, that is where I went. And during that time is where I developed the dinner roll. I was only skiing a handful of mogul competitions a year. I went and won the pro tour. And then actually I did piss them off, because the X Games, where I got silver to JF Kusan, I also got hurt in that competition before the competition. I still competed, but I had a hematoma on my back. And so I did not compete in the American World Cups. So I kind of, you know, they were right in that the X Games was, you know, to put me out for their domestic World Cups. So, but that's a whole different subject. Yeah. So I didn't have to do any like declaring this or declaring that. There was no, the Olympic Committee, they have no leg to stand on. But when I did kind of try to come back, when I decided that I could do this dinner roll, and I won the US Open with it and to 900 and all that stuff, that when I did decide I wanted to come back and rejoin to try to go to the Olympics, of course, there's only one route to the Olympics, and that's through the US ski team. So basically, they did not swing the doors open for me. They basically said, you got to go. Here's two World Cup spots. You got to get a podium in one of them. And that's it. So I had to freaking get myself back in order, get back into mogul skiing shape, which is not easy when you're coming from the slopestyle freeride tour. So I came back and I crashed in the first event and then got second in the next event on the East Coast. And that put me back on the team. And then the rest was, then you start to get into the story of me having to lobby and submit the trick for certification and approval and all that crap.
Which had to be tough, especially since you weren't proposing doing this in an aerial competition. You were proposing doing it in the chaos of a mogul competition, which if they were concerned about, you know, sending the wrong message to America's youth and we're all going to be paralyzed if we start doing flips and moguls or whatever, you were really going to say, we're going to take it right to the edge. We're going to throw this in a mogul competition. You can't tell me that my head's is out of position, because I'm keeping it at least parallel, not dropping below this magical line that you think becomes more dangerous. But it's pretty clear that particularly on the European side, officialdom didn't like being told that they're not following their own rules or you know, sort of poking them in the chest.
yeah. I mean, I think it was, you know, there's so much to unpack here. To me, it was very clear where the sport was going, right? Like, to me, I could see the demise of traditional moguls very clearly. It just in its, you know, just being around my peers, I could just see it kind of, you know, starting to wither a little bit, because so much of the good talent was going to slopestyle and X Games and stuff like that. And the sponsors were going there, everything. But to the FIS, it was not as clear. And, you know, that's just part of being a bureaucracy based in Europe, is they didn't really see the power of what was happening. So, and to be fair, I was definitely pushed up against a time constraint too, because if I think I rejoined the team in 2000, you know, that was when I did those World Cups to get back on the team. And then it was the end of that season that I, you know, so really you're just looking at the season before the Olympics to spring this new trick on them and possibly this whole new category. And that's why I did not try to, I knew that they would not change the inverted rule wholesale. I knew that that was going to be too close to the Olympics to say, okay, now inverted tricks are legal. Everyone's, because it would just be a nightmare for everyone. It would be unfair, truthfully, because you'd open it up to people. You know, everyone have to learn backflips and all that stuff. It, to me, it wasn't unfair. To me, I was pissed off because I had spent, you know, 3x hours learning ballet and aerials my whole life while all these guys specialized moguls. So I was like, yeah, they should have freaking kept doing, they should have done true freestyle stuff. So anyway, but anyway, I knew that wasn't going to happen. So that's where the whole my feet didn't go above my head thing became very important. So Cooper and I took a video of me doing the trick late in the spring in Palisades on a jump, and we filmed it from four different angles. And that went with our liaison to the FIS meetings, Jeff Winterstein, and they proposed it and proved that my feet were not over my head, so it wasn't an inverted trick. And they all took a vote and they approved it by one vote. And that was a joyous day. I was super happy. But I was also, in hindsight, is also the point that I'm the one of the reasons I missed winning. And we can get into that later. But that was the insertion point where I needed to lobby for a higher degree of difficulty. And we'll just leave it at that.
Well, let's get into the elephant in the room right now. So, your second run at Salt Lake, I believe, was the fastest, was it not?
No.
Were you?
No. Cold? No, I was slow. That was my biggest fault.
Ah, okay.
Yes, yes. And time is what, 25% of the score? So it's not the most important thing, but it's definitely important.
What are the other criteria that you aced?
Okay. Well, the air score is 25% and then the turns in line are 50%. So I was very high in all in those in the turn score. I was low in the time score and I was great in the air score, but it needed to be more. I essentially what I needed was and this goes to, I mean, I needed to be faster. I needed to be more. And here's the deal. The reason I had to go slower was because in order to do this trick, you have to do a little bit of setup, right? Like you got to keep your skis on the ground through the transition because you're basically going sort of, you know, semi-inverted and two rotations around versus my competitors who were doing what were standard tricks at the time called like a quad twister, where you just jump straight up and you twist your skis four times to the side, one time, done time, one time. Which isn't like the easiest trick. You still got to get, you got to get enough air to get your feet there.
Johnny,
but the difference,
I could do it.
the main difference with that type of trick, and this is where they fail to see when you're the guy doing something for the first time, why it's more difficult. When you do a quad twister, you can pretty much, you don't have to slow down at all going into the jump. In fact, like if you look at the guys who won there, they didn't even pop. They just basically straight lined into the jump and absorbed the takeoff, actually, then stood up and did like a quad twister and kept going. So that allowed them to do multiple things. It allowed them to kind of like go through the jump and create more speed. And really, they didn't have to slow down before that because they knew they could hit that thing full force. So it was a good strategy by them. It was my mistake for not lobbying to me. I thought I was naive enough to think that the judges were going to give me the benefit of the doubt and create more points in their execution score. And they just gave me a good score. They were constricted by the books, if you will. And there's a lot of fault in there. Of course, the next year they changed all the rules. They made my trick worth way more to the point where all twisters have been eliminated. Now everyone's doing some version of my trick. So it's just a case of being too early, a little naive, maybe not arguing back when they gave it that degree of difficulty. And then also maybe just in holistically, maybe running out of runway. For example, had I started doing that a year earlier, the season before, mm-hmm. I probably would have had a better idea. Now, you run the risk of letting people rip it off too. So there's that. In fact, Shaun White gave this interview after he did the McTwist to the Wall Street Journal, double McTwist, which he won with. And the reporter asked him, like, why, you know, this double McTwist, you did it so early. Weren't you afraid that the judges were going to, the people were going to rip you off? And he was like, yes, I was afraid of that, because he was inviting judges up to the side of the pipe to show him this new trick that he learned at the, you know, and he would show him why it was hard, why it was more difficult. But what he said to her was, yes, I knew I was taking that risk of someone else ripping it off, but I didn't want to suffer from the Johnny Mosley effect, meaning, he did. Yeah. And it's in the Wall Street Journal. And what he meant was, like, you know, if you're doing something new like that, you don't want to surprise people with it. You don't want, you got to understand your audience. You got to understand the judges. You got to understand FIS. You got to get in there and basically plant the, you know, seed the bed, if you will, for what you're about to do. And that was the mistake I made.
So despite being snubbed by the judges in Salt Lake, your public persona really skyrocketed thereafter. That's when you hosted Saturday Night Live, among other post-comp events. What was that like? Did you bond with any cast members in particular?
Oh, man, that's like a dream come true. Saturday Night Live, who would have thought? You know, they were so cool to me. Like, the first guy that I met was Jimmy Fallon, and he pretty much was took care of me the whole time. And, like, we took me to a Rangers game with Lorne Michaels, and he was just, like, on my hip. So, yeah, it was surreal. And, you know, there was a guy there as well that had, I think he was one of the guys who, when they were noodling on to, as to who was, you know, who would be, who, which of these Olympians coming out of the NBC 2002 Olympics could do SNL, was the guy who spoke up and was like, Mosley, Brandon Sennett is his name. Brendan, sorry. Anyway, so I had a lot of allies there, and these guys made it so fun. I mean, and it was a freaking packed cast, right? You had Tracy Morgan, Tina Fey. I loved hanging out with Amy Poehler, Maya Rudolph. I mean, it was just stacked. So Will Ferrell was still around. He was like phasing out. It was like, it was surreal. It was a great time.
Let's review some of your other post-competition highlights. You became the freestyle skiing analyst for NBC from 2010 in Vancouver to 2022. Mm-hmm. From a viewer's perspective, Vancouver was a fine show and the Canadians were terrific hosts, but China, not so much. What was your takeaway from the certainly visually dismal Chinese events? If on the other side of the coin, what was your favorite venue and why?
Yeah, I mean, they all had their own flavors. Vancouver was my first one, and very interesting. You know, I remember, I'll never forget the day, like, driving up to the venue and seeing these huge helicopters coming, you know, from way high up with these buckets of snow, pouring them on the mogul course. You know, those big ones that look like dragonflies. I don't know what they're called. And I am like, this is going to take a while. Like, these buckets compared to the hill look like tiny, look like 5 gallon buckets to try to fill a hill. But lo and behold, they pulled it off. So here's my analysis. I was basically in an era of commentating for the Olympics when I feel like in some ways the Olympics really jumped the shark, right? Like, started going to some really odd places that aren't really known for skiing. Now, I will say Sochi was incredibly beautiful, huge mountains. We skied every single day. The venues were connected, so we could, like, go up, get ready to go down and watch to work at the, you know, at the ski events, at the freestyle ski events. We could cruise over and watch the downhill, and the security, believe it or not, was kind of lax there. And there'd be big, like, Russian dudes in the woods with huge guns, but you could just ski right by them. But I don't know if you ever saw that footage. I was standing, like, with my ski tips underneath the fencing, watching Ted Ligety win the gold, getting a selfie. Like, you could never do that at any other Olympics. Like, you always have to be down in the corral. So that added highlights, but it was weird. It was like this makeshift city. There wasn't a lot of people there. The stands were empty. So that was weird. Korea was actually somewhat delightful. It was good. Kind of weird though, in its own way. But it was that was kind of more of a normal style Olympics. Nothing inspiring about the mountains we were at, but that was kind of probably the most normal one of the group. And then Beijing, you're right. I wasn't actually there at all, because I was there But at the last minute, I mean, I was there, I was commentating, but at the last minute, because of, you know, China's COVID policies, where they basically were like, if you test positive, we're putting you in a special hospital. The NBC basically held back all their, everybody held us all back with the exception of, I think, Mike Tirico and maybe a couple other like main hosts that only just went for a little bit and came back. The worry being that if you tested positive, they'd lose their announcer and then they'd have to like fill in with somebody else. So we actually all did that Olympics from Stamford, Connecticut, from their studios. So, which actually was pretty, we were all there. It was like a hotel in Greenwich, Connecticut with every Olympic gold medalist, you know, all in this small boutique hotel. It was actually quite fun. We had a great time, but
Greenwich, but yes, Olympics. I love it.
It was, I can't even, I'm not even sure I can categorize the Beijing Olympics because I really wasn't even boots on the ground. But yes, I mean, in my opinion, my humble opinion with the Olympic stuff is they got to get back to like where they're going now, which is Cortina, places that I understand trying to like spread the gospel. But I mean, at some point, it's got to be a spot that is a viable ski location that people might want to go. And it's for the athlete's sake, too.
It has just a little bit of charm to it. I mean, the Chinese, just the visual appearance of the runs, it was just grim.
Yeah. 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 No, and it's funny, I had been to that previous to the actual Olympics, Beijing Olympics. I was in that location where the freestyle events were at Genting Secret Garden. And I went for like a demo to promote the Olympics. I think it was on like a junket with Visit California or Palisades Tahoe or something. And I did like a little mogul demo. And I just remember being like, oh, this place is miserable. It was like tundra. It was like blowing and cold. The mountains aren't steep. It's all man-made snow. I think they get like 50 inches of 50 centimeters of natural snow a year. I remember going to the half pipe and being like, oh my God, these poor guys. And yeah, then, you know, you ended up having those really windy conditions for the half pipe. Remember they had to put up that like big screen to block the wind.
It totally screwed a Reno local who was on his way to his third gold medal in halfpipe.
Right.
Blown out of the pipe on his last run. That's
gnarly. Yeah. They can't do that stuff. Yeah. I don't know what they're doing. It's got to be. Yeah. That's disappointing.
For 3 years, you hosted a show called The Challenge on MTV. For those of us who missed it, what was that about?
The Challenge. Yeah. The Challenge. Well, it was a reality show. And if you remember the first reality show, which was The Real World, that was a very popular show for MTV. And they kept spinning other popular shows off of it, including a show called the Real World. No, what was it called? Road Rules, where they did the same thing, where they all lived in a house. Sorry, The Real World was like six guys and girls living in a house, and then whatever happened. They filmed everything, and the good, the bad, and the ugly. It was more like a psychological thriller, right? Like how people were reacting and stuff like that. And then they did this other show called Road Rules, which was where they did the same thing, but they traveled. They were in a camper vans and going around. And then right around that time, Fear Factor became kind of popular, where people do like challenges. So then they decided to create a spinoff where they took the most prolific characters from Real World and the most prolific characters from Road Rules, and they put them together and had them compete in like sort of weird games and live together and in separate houses. And then they would film the fallout, which, you know, ends up being lots of fighting and drama. Oh, yeah. So how did
your role?
So they brought me in as a ref, basically. And I think from what I understand, so I was hosting Saturday Night Live and someone saw me from MTV and called me in for an audition like the next day. And I auditioned and they ended up hiring me for this series. And I think what they said was, what's revealing is why they used me is when I sat down to do my contract, it had stuff in it like no fraternizing with the cast. There was a stipend to bring my significant other if I had one. Basically, they were saying like they wanted to bring in someone who had familiarity with athletic events but was not connected to the show, because they had previous to when they had done the test, the kind of like test shows, they had used some of the contestants, and because they were giving away money, it was a game show, they were having issues because the contestants were hooking up with cast, and there's like, you know, they can get in trouble with the game show commission and all that stuff. So essentially they were looking for someone that could be on TV, introduce the games, have some quips here and there, but also like manage a competition in a way. And so I guess that was the criteria that I fit.
Another post competitive career highlight. You began being the voice of the Warren Miller film starting in 2007, which just so happens I missed writing your scripts by about a year because I was the first person hired to write for Warren. Warren had never had anyone else's words slipped in front of him that he's supposed to read into the microphone. He wasn't happy.
That must have been very uncomfortable, Jackson. I mean, and you're right next to Warren Miller. You're Skeen's best writer. So, I mean, they got the best, but you know, it's not the same, right? That must have been crazy. So what would he do? What would he say? Like, that's not really something I would say, or would he say
that? It was just that, you know, Warren Miller is most famous, I think, for his cadence and the warmth of his voice. I mean, you can almost take a bath in Warren's narration. It's so sort of rich and soupy, but now he's reading someone else's words. So it's like, here we are in
interesting
place to be in France. You know, it lasted one more year of me writing another script for him. And then Warren told his kid at Warren Miller Entertainment, we're done.
Yeah. Right.
The Yellowstone Club and said that enough of that.
Interesting. Yeah, that's hey, look, we've all been part of this transition to kind of like keep this Warren Miller thing as part of our vernacular. And it you know, that was, no one was ever going to replace Warren. And it's just like impossible to get inside his head. And then you're right. He's not going to read the same. He's not going to read something that he didn't write with the same type of understanding or cadence. So that's challenging. I mean, I remember when they asked me to do it the first time, and obviously I was a huge fan of Warren and was like blown away the first time I got to actually ski in a movie. Then to be asked to narrate it, I was like, dude, I don't want to ruin this movie, you know? And and let's like read a couple pages and show a test audience. Like, there's no amount of money you're going to pay me to be vilified by the whole like ski community for ruining Warren Miller films. And they're like, no, you got to do it, man. So I jumped in the booth. I remember the first time, and I was reading the script, I guess, and the whole board, you know, where they're in the other room and the tech guys are twisting on knobs and stuff is filled with like Warren Miller executives or whatever. And I'm just, you can tell I'm bombing. They're like looking at each other and it's just not the same because they're thinking they're trying to replace Warren. And then the door swings open and in comes a six pack, and you know, it's been going fine ever since. So we're making our way. It's not Warren, but people have generally accepted it, and I'm grateful for that. So
it's a great honor, I would say, to
definitely
follow Warren in any way. Any advice for kids out there who'd like to follow in your tracks?
When you really dig into it, it's the interest in the, like doing the little drills, like working on the little fundamentals that you can control, like trying to figure out just one way, like how to get 10% better at getting your turn, getting up more angle on your edge, or getting your hand in the right spot, or, you know, figuring out how to hit that pad, like hit that landing just right by practicing, breaking down all the elements into little controllable practice moves. That's what really separates people, and you know, the rest falls in place, I think, you know. And so I think if I were giving advice to a kid, I'd just be like, get into the drills, get into the like breaking down, you know, the fundamentals of what you're trying to do, and try to get it down to its simplest elements, and try to just keep working on those little things, and the rest will fall in place.
That's really good advice. Now, to your very great credit, you finished your college education. You began at UC Davis, but training demands caused you to end your time there prematurely. But you went back and completed your degree in American Studies at Berkeley, not exactly a slouch institution, graduated in 2007. Not many athletes would bother once they'd achieved professional and financial success. What inspired you to stick it out and get your sheepskin?
I don't know, a couple things. I mean, like I said, I told you about my brother who was really like, you know, influential in my life, both brothers, but the one I spent more time with skiing and on the road. And he was this kind of like dichotomy between really athletic, super competitive, but we'd have these long drives and he'd be talking about books he read at Steppenwolf and teaching me like physics and the first laws of thermodynamics. And so he really kind of piqued my interest in learning stuff. And then I went to a small private high school that where I got my ass kicked for a year. And I realized like, it's actually kind of fun and competitive to try to be competitive in academics. And so I started to derive some joy from that, you know, getting better in math and like learning and laying down a good paper or doing something, learning something in physics, doing a good job. And so I kind of, that seed had been planted. And then obviously my goal to ski and win the Olympics had superseded that. So I really left all that behind, but it never really left my craw. It was still stuck in my brain. I was still always, my brother went to school to be a mechanical engineer and finished off when he quit skiing. He had terrible like back pain and sleeping issues. So he bailed and went back to school. So in my mind, I was like, I'm going to finish school. I might even end up becoming a mechanical engineer, or like I definitely had, I was always kind of a hedging for like the end of the ski life. And also just sort of like, I want to finish that. Like I kind of want to, I started this. And so I did, I obviously applied to undergrad after high school and chose Davis and over LA because I wanted to be, I was only going for like a quarter at a time. And so I was really only, you know, coming home in the spring, going for 3 months, and which all dissipated because about a year out of the Olympics, I remember my coach being like, "Where are you?" I'm like, "I'm at school. I always go to school in the spring." He's like, "Dude, what? Not this time." So I fly back and start training. And then after the 02 Olympics, you know, at 98, obviously went nuts and like my life changed forever. And from a financial perspective, from just a like notoriety perspective. And actually at that time, I tried to quit and go back to school too. My shoulder was hanging from a thread. I was tired of competing and tired of training and burnout. And so I moved to LA and enrolled in UCLA and started to go and got about 2 months into kind of, you know, making up for my lost time in summer school before I was like, oh my God, my career's just getting started. Like this is now where it's good. I'm actually making great money. The sport's going and like I got to bail again. So I bailed out of there. I still had only accumulated about less than a year of credits and then went back and did my run to the O2 Olympics and still had it in the back of my mind, even though now I had done a bunch of TV stuff. And then after the O2 Olympics, I was like, now I'm really done. And I had given the commencement at Cal. That was like a weird thing that I had been asked to do. And I like went to the guy. I was like, you know, I'm thinking about going back to school. I live up here. Can I transfer back in there? So I transferred over there. And then I just went full time and I committed to it. And I honestly thought that I would maybe find something else. Like I would get into something and start a different career. I was genuinely kind of poking around on that stuff. But I ended up not doing that. I ended up just sort of like, you know, continuing with my career as it is.
Returning to our time together at Head, I want to share with my dear listeners my firsthand impression of Johnny Mosley, the person as opposed to the celebrity. I never had to worry about your public comportment, Johnny, while under contract with Head. To put it succinctly, you were raised properly. Your manners were always impeccable, regardless of the circumstances. Even on the golf course, where composure is easily fractured, you remained the complete gentleman, which I know because we were partnered together at the well-known celebrity golf event in South Lake Tahoe at Edgewood Golf Course. And throughout that round, which we both added a lot of extra strokes to the experience, again, you were just seamless in terms of your comportment. To add another quick anecdote for my dear listeners, in one of your first competitions after signing with Head, which was a period which was fraught for quite a few reasons, you blew out of a Tirolia binding on takeoff at a big air event. And I can't believe that didn't cause you a little bit of discomfort, displeasure, or whatever, but you never brought it up to me. Your traveling helpmate, Nadia, let me know. But you never held it against me personally that you weren't getting the proper on-event support that you needed out of our brand. And you worked diligently with Head product people and transitioned from a Lang to a Head boot. And that process was not exactly seamless. But you remained at all times the complete professional, the perfect gentleman. Johnny, you have a lot to be proud of, not just as an athlete, but as a husband, a father, and a friend. Your success is richly deserved.
Thank you. That's really, really appreciate that. That was a very nice compliment, because I do sometimes I look back at those years in my mid-20s and I'm like, man, I was such a punk. And so I never know, you know, who I stepped on at this point and was rude to. And I appreciate that. At least overall, I can count you as someone that I treated with respect.
Greatly appreciated, Johnny. Thanks for appearing on Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan.
I love you, Jackson. You're the best. You're a gem. Thank you.
And thank you, dear listeners, for listening. I also want to thank you for all your kind forbearance during the past few weeks, as I've fallen short of my self-imposed regimen of at least one podcast per week during the ski season. This time of year is always a challenge, and the challenges aren't getting any easier to manage. Please bear with me as I strive to deliver the best content I can for you, my dear listeners.